Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Morris Ardwin, a co-host for the podcast Queer Voices of the South. Today, I'm talking with Jim Downs about his book Stand By Me, The Forgotten History of Gay Liberation. Paperback edition released earlier this year by University of Georgia Press. Welcome, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Jim Downs is the Gilder Lehrman NEH Professor of Civil War Studies at Gettysburg College. He's the author of the critically acclaimed Sick from Freedom, African-American Illness and Suffering During the Civil War and Reconstruction. He has also written for Time, The Huffington Post, and The New York Times, among other publications. A little bit about the book, Stand By Me, Forgotten History of Gay Liberation. It's the untold story of the rich variety of gay life in America in the 1970s. Despite the tremendous gains of the LGBT movement in recent years, the history of gay life in this country remains poorly understood. According to conventional wisdom, gay liberation started with the Stonewall riots in Greenwich Village in 1969. The 1970s represented a moment of triumph, both political and sexual, before the AIDS crisis in the subsequent decade, which in the view of many exposed the problems inherent in the so-called gay lifestyle. In Stand By Me, the acclaimed historian Jim Downs rewrites the history of gay life in the 1970s, arguing that the decade was about much more than sex and marching in the streets. Drawing on a vast trove of untapped records of LGBT community centers in Los Angeles, New York, and Philadelphia, Downs tells moving, revelatory stories of gay people who stood together as friends, fellow believers, and colleagues to create a sense of community among people who felt alienated from mainstream American life. As Downs shows, gay people found one another in the Metropolitan Community Church, a nationwide gay religious group, in the pages of The Body Politic, a newspaper that encourages readers to think of their sexuality as a political identity, and at the Oscar Wilde Memorial Bookstore, the hub of gay literary life in New York City, and at theaters putting on Gay American History, a play that brought to the surface the enduring problem of gay oppression. These and many other achievements would be largely forgotten after the arrival of in early 1980s of HIV/AIDS, which allowed critics to claim that sex was the defining feature of gay liberation. This reductive narrative set back the cause of gay rights and has shaped the identities of gay people for decades. An essential act of historical recovery, Stand By Me shines a bright light on a triumphant moment and will transform how we think about gay life in America from the 1970s into present day. Jim, tell us the difference between gay rights and gay liberation. What is that?
So I would describe gay rights as any opportunity by the gay community to gain rights from the state, from government. So the right to marry, the right for equal pay, the right for better housing conditions, etc. Gay liberation was different. It didn't attempt to have gay people genuflect to the state and ask for rights. It instead imagined a revolution. If we think about that today within the contemporary context, we can say that within the Democrat or even Republican Party, that there's not one message from each party, that there's factions, there's variations along an ideological spectrum. And I think that's what was happening in the 1970s, is that there was in fact a spectrum of beliefs. And in fact, many gay people who were at the forefront of the liberation movement were imagining a revolution. And that revolution, in many respects, ultimately paved the way for what we consider to be rights. But if they had just gone for rights, I'm not convinced it would have worked. It was because they believed in a big revolution that provided a framework for the rise of rights that we enjoy today.
You break the book up into six or seven realms where it's you mentioned already the that gay people created a lexicon, an idiom, using newspapers, or prayer groups, churches, beauty contests, and bars, and bookstores of their own. It's all this cultural history that has long been forgotten. Tell us about how it started. You start with an incident in New Orleans in 1973. That's where you begin the book. Tell us about how that and the religious movement, they played together. Those first two chapters of your book really come together to explain that. Give us a little bit more about that.
Right. So when we think about what does it mean to come out of the closet? What does it mean to be gay? These are not just about sort of a world of intimacy. It's not just about a fun night out and a Saturday night at a gay bar. The idea of coming out meant that gay people were embracing an identity that was steeped within a particular culture and community. And so the question then becomes, well, what was that culture in the community? It just didn't naturally exist. It wasn't just there. So what I look at are the ways in which gay people worked to create a type of culture that would help to shape and inform a community so that when people came out, that identity of being gay was not just about what people called in the 1970s a sexual preference, but it was about being part of a community and culture. And so then in the 1970s, when we think about what distinguishes or what makes that culture, certainly sex does. Sex is a huge part of it. Having sex with people of the same sex, going to bathhouses, going to orgies, being engaged in that world of sex is definitely a huge part of it. But we know that. Most people know that is the history of the 1970s. We don't know the sort of quiet work, the more subtle work that led to the stitching together of this community. And one of them was the creation of newspapers. Newspapers became a way that connected people in bustling urban centers to small rural towns. It connected large communities of gay people to individuals who were living by themselves. The newspaper informed people about what was going on in the gay world. There were stories about politics, but there were also stories about the culture, everything from what was happening in the community to what kind of events were taking place, to just reviews of films or plays or other kinds of forms of entertainment. And that's what actually did the sort of quiet work of building together a community and a culture. And so one of the people that I focus on in the book is a guy by the name of Craig Rodwell. And Craig Rodwell is someone who I hope in 100 years will be added to every history textbook. In the way that we know of Harriet Tubman and Rosa Parks for Black history, we should know of Craig Rodwell for the 1970s, because Rodwell actually witnessed, he wasn't a participant, at least for the first day at the Stonewall Uprising, but he heard the commotion when he was walking home to from his West Village apartment, and he jumped up on a stoop and screamed the words gay power. So he's there at this sort of legendary moment in our history. But then he was also extraordinarily politically active before 1969, before the Stonewall Uprising. In fact, he leaves Chicago. He had studied ballet. He comes to New York, and he's part of the Mattachine Society, which was the underground political group that many gay people were involved in the 1950s and early 1960s. The Mattachine Society, by many historians' evaluations, was a kind of conservative group because they kind of kept quiet their political objectives. They didn't want to cause trouble, etc. Rodwell was a younger member. He was actually the vice president of the group. And he wanted people, he was a child of the 60s. He grew up doing civil rights work, working in anti-racist movements. He had studied civil rights in Chicago. So he approaches this question of gay politics from the perspective of Black civil rights. And part of Black civil rights at the time was promoting what people call the politics of respectability, promoting positive images that could be embraced by non-Black people to support Black civil rights. So he says to the Mattachine Society, we need to get out there and we need to promote positive images of ourselves, and they're afraid to do it. And so he said, we need to create a storefront that's open to people where they can see who we are, and we should no longer be hidden underground. We should no longer be hidden behind closed doors. And they say, you know, we'll get bottles thrown through the windows. You know, people will attack us. We'll be targeted. And so what he does is he disagrees with them and he decides to do it on his own. And this is a moment like New York history, which you it could never happen again, but maybe now with the city sort of on a sort of downward spiral, maybe this could happen. But he decides to want to open his own bookstore. So he goes to Fire Island, which is a beach resort, gay beach resort at the time, still is, works as a bartender, comes home with a bucket of money, and is able to rent a storefront, which again, this is like this New York moment that you could never do that today, but you could do that in 1967. So he wants to establish a bookstore, and he calls it the Oscar Wilde Bookstore because he wants a recognizable name that would be a kind of code for queer people to know what it was, because Wilde is this sort of legendary queer icon at the time. But he wants the bookstore to not only sell books by gay people, about gay people, he wants it to also serve as a community hub for queer people, because this is during a time when there isn't yet a gay community center. There's one in San Francisco that's starting to develop, but you don't today, if you go to most big cities, Chicago, Philadelphia, et cetera, you're going to find a community center. You didn't have that in 1967. There wasn't a visible space for people to come to outside of the bar culture. So Rodwell was kind of he wasn't anti-sex. I mean, the misreading of him is to say like he's puritanical. He's not puritanical. He's actually really into sex. He goes cruising. He has a relationship with a guy who's like a Wall Street type, and they wake up every morning and they call each other. And you know, he had met this guy at a cruising park, and this guy has like an interesting story. He at first, you know, disagrees with Rodwell's politics. He doesn't like Rodwell, being so outwardly gay and political, but ultimately learns a lot from Rodwell. One morning he calls up Rodwell and he says, hey, I've contracted gonorrhea. And Rodwell says, yeah, okay. And he said, but I don't understand. We were supposed to be monogamous. And Rodwell said, well, no, I never said that. So the guy dumps Rodwell. He's really upset. And he eventually moves to San Francisco, and everybody knows him as Harvey Milk. So Rodwell had a relationship with Milk, and Milk then opens his infamous camera shop in the Castro, and that camera shop becomes, like Rodwell's bookstore in New York, a community hub. It becomes an incubator for political activism, but also becomes a place where gay people can hang out. So this is the kind of work that gay people were engaged in doing in the 1970s. There were the sweaty struggles in the streets, which are thrilling and exciting, and there were all of those things, but there was also the quiet work. But getting back to the sweaty struggles in the streets, Rodwell is one of the first gay people to attend the first outward public demonstrations in Philadelphia before Stonewall in 1965 in Philadelphia at the Liberty Bell. He, by attending them, when Stonewall happens, the year anniversary, he, along with a couple of other people, become the architects of what becomes known as Christopher Street, because that's the main street in New York. Christopher Street Day, it's called the Christopher Street Day Parade or something like that. Ultimately, it's the last Sunday in June, and this commemoration is what now becomes infamously known as sort of the Gay Pride in New York. So Rodwell is like at the center of like the beginning of gay pride events. He's at the first gay thing in New York. He creates the first gay bookstore in the world. In fact, I mentioned this in my book, people from all over the world come to his store and they write to him and they ask him about how he did it. And ultimately they set up shops in London and other places. There's a shop in Philadelphia called Giovanni's Room that was in fact, you know, grew out of what Weil did. And so, I mean, I'm sorry, what Rodwell did. So he's really a key figure in thinking about gay liberation and thinking about how just literature and books become a way to help inform a community. I have one of the stories that I read that I loved reading was that a guy who is a soldier in Vietnam. And here we are thinking like Vietnam, the sort of height of hyper masculinity. And one of these soldiers is writing from Vietnam to Rodwell saying, I have, you know, some magazines that I bought at your store, some gay magazines, and some books. And I can't wait to come back when I'm eventually discharged to, you know, see what else you have on your shelves. So it is a store that's a beacon around the world. And it's quite fascinating. And today, you know, with the decline of independent bookstores and so forth, we kind of, again, don't realize how important it was then to have something like this.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. And it's that whole area of setting up a safe place for people to go where they actually felt they belonged. And it was a critical piece of the movement, just saying your identity is valid. And so you talk about that in other areas of the book, for example, the body politic, you mentioned that, how that came to be. And it had so many, pieces just like this, the cat story, is that it started turning all kinds of wheels by existing, and it started moving, the communities all over the country and in the world to have their own publications. You said it, I think, in the book that it was considered the New York Review of Books, the gay community's version of the New York Review of Books. Tell us about the body politic a little bit, how that got started. We mentioned it very briefly, but will you give us a little bit more background on that?
So what happens is that when we're thinking about the ways in which various communities and cultures actually remain connected, we have to think about what are the tools that do that. And so newspapers are a great way. And so in every major city and even in smaller communities, there were gay newspapers throughout the 1970s. I picked the body politic because it was one of the more prevalent ones. And it had a serial run that lasted over a decade. And basically, when I was interviewing people from the period who are still alive today, they talked about the significance of the body politic, in particular, the fact that the reporting and the writing was equal to, as Jonathan Ed Katz, who's the subject of the book, mentioned, it was like the gay New York Review of Books. And so there were lots of different kinds of articles in it. There was reporting on the politics, but there was also lots of stuff on the culture at the time. There was a lesbian feminist writer by the name of Chris Birchall, who is an incisive critic and thinker, and she's written a lot of great stuff. So it's a really interesting to kind of think about how the body politic was an important paper that helped gay people develop both a political and a cultural identity, and how they were able to sort of stay in touch. There were incidents where you had problems in, I mean, I mentioned this in the book, where there were problems in South America. They only found out about problems in South America because gay people who were readers there were in contact with gay readers in Australia. Those readers in Australia contacted people in Toronto. Toronto then reports on what's happening in South America. So there really is this sort of way in which the paper, you know, stitches together this world and stitches together the concerns of gay people around the world. I was kind of working with a concept that never really panned out, but, you know, gay people's identity often transcended their national border. So that even though the paper was published in Canada, it's most of its readers were in the United States, but then also through Europe, but also in Europe, South America, and other places. It's almost like their gay identity like transcends these national borders, and they see themselves as a community around the world. And so the paper provides evidence of that kind of global community.
And again, it also validates as a community. It's not just a rag. It's, like you said, it had lots of different types of content and writers, like the writer you mentioned, who started looking at things in ways that were much more in depth than the original bits and pieces of the gay publishing world, which were sometimes pamphlets and community newsletters and things like that. So it helps solidify and validate. There are other parts of your book where you look at its behavior. You're looking at behavior. One of the things I found very interesting is the macho man, the clone, who started taking over what gay people began to idolize. But it also had some. It also caused some problems, such as racism and sexism. Tell us about that macho man clone and how that whole thing fits into this story.
Right. So when we think about the early moment of the start of the modern gay liberation movement, we see it with the rise of Stonewall. And there's lots of ways we can like complicate that history or call that into question whether or not Stonewall is this sort of pivotal moment. But for argument's sake, particularly in relation to the clone, let's just say this is an important starting point. During the starting point, when we think about who actually participated in Stonewall, it wasn't just white gay men. There were lesbians, there were trans people, there were what people called at the time street queens, there were drag queens. We know now there's like a statue going up to honor Marsha Johnson. And so we have at the sort of, if we agree that Stonewall's the sort of birth of the modern gay liberation movement, it's actually a quite diverse population of people who participate in this moment. And yet, when we get to the end of the 1970s, white gay men come to represent the entire decade. And yet we started off fairly diverse. So that's also, my question is like, well, how did that happen and why did that happen? And when I went through the records, when I was going through the community center records and I was going through the newspapers and I was going through a lot of the surviving material, a lot of what I was finding was just really the stories of white gay people. And the question is, well, what happened to black people? What happened to women? What happened to these other groups? And exactly. As a historian, I am interested in culture. So like I would say, just for the heck of it, I would say like a Beyonce song is just as important as a Michelle Obama speech, right? Because both of them are text and both of them can tell us something. You know, some people would say, well, no, if Michelle Obama gives a speech, that's going to be at a Democrat National Convention. That is legitimately more important. As a cultural historian, I would never legitimate one text over the other. I would say they both can tell us different things. They're both doing different kinds of work. They both have different types of objectives. They're both useful for us to examine. So similarly, when I'm asking this question about what's happening at the end of the 1970s, I started seeing in the gay newspapers, there were lots of images of gay people. And in the early part of the decade, you had really thin gay guys. You had really large gay guys. You had, again, a full diversity of body type represented. By the end of the decade, it's all become this sort of what they call the clone, the sort of macho, the macho clone, this idea of he's muscular, he could potentially wear jeans or leather, he's got big pecs, he's got cannonball-sized biceps, he's masculine, you know, the focus on masculinity is really important. And then, of course, he's white. The clone is not black. The clone is white. Right. And so, and the clone is male. And so this popular cultural representation in many respects reflects the aspirations of the community, and it represents what matters in the community, and it becomes a discriminatory force in opposing what doesn't belong in the community. So every now and again, you'll find a one or two sprinkled in a black guy that will look like that, but mostly not. It's mostly white. And so what I argue is that the emphasis on the clone becomes sort of culturally symbolic in terms of illustrating to the gay world and the gay community at a time, what matters is masculinity, whiteness, manhood, and a certain kind of physicality, and everything else that doesn't fit into this mold gets pushed to the side. And so that's why we have the movement, I think. I mean, it's a cultural argument, but it's why we have the sort of movement going from a very diverse group of people led by gay liberationists who were anti-racist, who accepted both men and women. I mean, I have articles about men talking about how they were struggling with feminism, like men being like, okay, we've heard a critique launched at us by lesbians that were sexist, and that's the reason why they, lesbians, have formed their own organizations. Well, let me reflect on that. Like, what does that mean? How am I like in some way espousing patriarchal ideas without knowing it? So there were gay guys in the early part of the liberation movement who were reflecting on early forms of feminism and reflecting on what it meant to be a man. All of that stuff that fills the pages of newspapers sort of gets erased by and goes by the wayside in the early part of the 1980s and the end of the 1970s in favor of this masculinist notion of the clone. More to the point, because of the HIV/AIDS crisis, all the intellectual energy then has to get devoted not to sort of thinking about themselves or their relationship to sexism and feminism. It has to go towards HIV. But more importantly, the clone then becomes sort of reified as this type of body type that can shield people from the onslaught of the epidemic. So there's another way that the clone can, by the early 80s, represent positive health. So all of these are like forces that I think lead to the sort of pushing away of gay people. But I have to tell you, I'm still working on that. Still working on this question because I'm not entirely satisfied. And so I just have an article that I just finished last week, and it's going to be out in a book next week. And I really like wanted to think, all right, well, what are black people saying? Because the reality of it is, if you go to the gay community centers, which are the best repositories for gay life in the 1970s, there's very little about gay black people in the 70s. In the 80s, there is around HIV/AIDS. And there's a new book coming out by a historian at I think it's like Florida International University, who's written about black gay men's response to the HIV epidemic. That's going to be a great book. In the 70s, all right, it's a completely different period. A lot of gay black men, I think, see the kind of racism among this kind of reifying of whiteness and realize this is not a community for them. I actually found a really powerful quotation by James Baldwin, which is not in my book, but will be in the article, in which he says, that term means nothing to me. You know, when he's interviewed, and the interview, you can look it up, it's within The Nation reproduced it just a couple years ago. The Nation found, or was it The Village Voice? I don't remember. The Nation or The Village Voice found an interview with Baldwin. And James Baldwin is obviously the most prolific gay person of the 20th century. So here we have someone who is going to leave us some kind of archival evidence about this intersection of race and sex, sexuality. And for him, the gay liberation movement is literally white. He doesn't see himself as part of it. He doesn't actually he's not compelled to be sympathetic to their arguments, and he's divorced from it. So when we go back and we look at the archives and we go, well, where are the black voices? Well, there are very few, in part because for them, being gay is a white, the liberation movement is a white person's movement. And Baldwin even says the same thing too. And I think there's more evidence to support this around women. Like, you know, you might not see a lot of women involved in certain versions of feminism because certain versions of feminism are not only discriminatory towards Black women, but have also, you know, not offered them the space, which is why you have all of these things, these anthologies that are published by Kitchen Table Press and all these other groups, by Black feminists, by the Kumbahi River Collective and so forth, that grow out of this angst, that this tension and this oppression. I haven't seen a similar sort of group that developed for gay men, of gay Black men, but there is this kind of sexism and racism that have contributed to these worlds.
At the same time, though, there is a little bit of a silver lining in that clone, is that it's not just the negative. It did help, like other things that you bring out in the book, about like the religious movement, like the movement of bookstores. It did help, even though it was exclusionary, it did help solidify a certain amount of the population around an ideal. As limited as it was, it helped in that regard.
Right. So everything is right. So everything is, I mean, it depends on the community, it depends on the place. So in certain populations, in certain places, there was the organization of the gay churches, and the gay churches articulate it as sort of opportunity for all people to participate. And you did see more Black, you know, it being more diverse. And in fact, the cover of this book, of the 2020 paperback edition, again, it shows you how historians are constantly doing research and finding new sources. It's an image that captures a group of young men outside a meeting of the Metropolitan Community Church. And they're Black men, they're Latino men, and they're white men. And so I think that is sort of an important thing to say, that we have photographic documentary evidence that the MCC was, as I suggested, it was open to all people, and that it was a space where people of color felt connected to other gay people.
Thank you. I know we are short on time. But I want to thank you for coming or joining the podcast. It's very important to us to hear voices from the queer community. Right. And we focus on things Southern, and you have a lot about the South in here. The South is always part of the national story, whether it wants to be or not. But we're run out of time. There's so much more in this book. I really urge the listeners to get this book. It's Stand By Me, The Forgotten History of Gay Liberation. You just mentioned it's now out in paperback by the University of Georgia Press. Please join us again next time for Queer Voices of the South. Goodbye, everybody, and thanks again, Jim.
Thank you so much for having me.